This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Mike O'Neill here. Mike Russell is on his way in. Will be joining us en route. We are in part two, Perspectives on Arizona History. Our guest today is, in my opinion, the most important person in Arizona history that you may have never heard of. Now, if you were an Arizona governor, my guess is the last 40 years or so, they probably had you all had you on speed dial. Maybe not Evan Meekum.
Not Evan Meekum, you're right.
With that exception, well-known in political power circles, depending on your attunement to local politics, may or may be not a household name. By the way, in this series, next week, Governor Fife Symington, a lot of history and one blockbuster statement I can promise you. And week four, historian batting cleanup, Jack August. Last week, we interviewed Marshall Trimble, also historian, and that interview is available on ktar.org. Good luck finding this show. It will be on my site, mikeoneill.org, maybe a little easier to find. Anyway, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to talk about, and it is the topic for you, power in Arizona. And I want to go back historically, and let's put this all in a context. It's the end of the Second World War, and what is charter government, and how does that come to be?
Well, first, Phoenix used to be a corrupt, wild, lawless Western town, and during World War II, it was off base to some of the surrounding air bases because there was just so much prostitution, gambling, and crime, and a group of And the politics were fairly corrupt. A group of Midwesterners who came here during that period, Gene Pullinger from Indiana, Walter Bimson from Illinois, Frank Snell from Kansas, got together and decided that they needed to clean up the town. And they formed the Charter Government Committee.
And these are the major. These are the heads of major institutions.
This is Valley Bank, the Arizona Republic, and Snell and Wilmer.
They're sort of the big three in Phoenix.
The big three at that time. And they recognized that politicians should fix policy and we should get the best staff to actually operate the city. So they set up what was called a council-manager form of government, where the city manager, in effect, is the CEO and the policy is fixed by the council. They did not want a strong mayor. They wanted to make sure they brought citizens into government and then they moved on after two terms. And one of the first persons they brought in on the first charter slate was Barry Goldwater. And as Barry was fond of saying, it was easy for me to get elected because all the prostitutes in town voted for me.
And prone to that kind of
yes,
talk.
He loved it. So at any event, charter government did a wonderful job cleaning up Phoenix, making it the best managed city in the world. Ed Bertelsmann has so designated it, I think, three times now. And we just take good government for granted here. But we've had superb city managers. We've had mayors coming in and out of office. But they don't stay and they don't. And frankly, it's been very difficult for them to step from there to the governorship because they really are just civic-minded businessmen and businesswomen. Charter government was starting to fade in the 70s, and Bill Shover, who was head of public relations at the Arizona Republic, and I got together, and we approached Bimson, Pulliam, Snell and said, we need to renew the leadership. You guys are getting tired, getting old. We didn't say it quite that bluntly.
But that was the inference.
But that was the message. And they understood.
That's pretty upstart thing. You're in your 20s, I think, at the time.
Is that? I was actually 30.
Okay.
we succeeded in setting up Phoenix 40. And Phoenix 40 did a very good job of helping plan ahead and to work with government.
So who's in the Phoenix 40? And it's initially that's a secret, right? That's not. It wasn't until I believe very late 70s that they went public.
We actually had a good opening press conference where we just revealed all the names, and it was clear that the community was ready for that. We called it Phoenix 40 because we're 40 people at the first meeting, but we had the representatives of God, we had Monsignor Donahoe, we had Rabbi Plotkin. You know, we really covered all the bases.
Well, it covered all the bases. It was all old white men.
Well, let's just
with the exception of yourself, who was a younger white man.
Yeah, we weren't even aware of that then.
Yep.
But we're very aware of it now.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see Sharon Harper is the new chairman of Greater Phoenix Leadership, which is the new name for Phoenix 40. She's doing a wonderful job.
This must have been heady stuff for you. I mean, you're in the room with the rest of them are all 30 years older than you, minimum, right?
Yes. I was having fun.
Yeah.
but I was also serving as the kind of executive director of this, and I did that for many years.
And what's the purpose of Phoenix 40, and how does that differ from charter government? Is it just an extension of the same thing?
Phoenix 40 did not pretend to dominate the selection of city council. Charter government, and I was chair of charter government for 2 years until had a disagreement. Bruce Merrill and I wanted to open it up, and we also wanted to support Margie Hantz for mayor. And the old guys selected Lyman Davidson. And so we just withdrew from charter government. And we backed Margie. So, and Margie was marvelous. I mean, she was the kind of person that gave people an optimistic confidence about the future.
We'll continue this discussion, and I want to give you a foretaste of the first question I want to ask. The columnist John Talton wrote, as we now evolve from the Phoenix 40 into Greater Phoenix Leadership, he once wrote, "The legendary group, meaning the Phoenix 40, has morphed into the benign and toothless Greater Phoenix Leadership." Benign and toothless. When we come back, I'd like your take on that. We're in the Think Tank on KTAR 92.3 FM.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with power broker Dick Mallory, longtime mover and shaker in the state of Arizona. And I left you with a cliffhanger, a John Talton quote. He was talking about the evolution of the Phoenix 40, which he said, and I quote, "The legendary group," referring to the Phoenix 40, "has morphed into the benign and toothless Greater Phoenix Leadership." I'd like your take on that.
Well, you know, I enjoy John Talton. I think he's very amusing. And I really disagree with that statement. Phoenix 40, when it started, we didn't have a staff, we didn't have a budget, and we just ran it. If we needed to meet with the legislature, we went out and met with the legislature, the individual CEOs. And it worked very well. Today, they have a great staff, and I think that the quality of the resources and the decisions are better. Lisa Adkins is brilliant and as wise as you're going to find in public policy and in legislative counseling. I think Tom France has been a really great president. Phoenix is very different today than it was back in the 70s when Phoenix 40 was started. I think that we have some we've lost some power players. The banks are no longer controlled locally, the big banks. The paper is now owned by Gannett. But we have these marvelous foundations. I think Piper, Pulliam, Flynn, these foundations really do provide great resources and judgment to the power structure in Arizona. I also think that
We have continued to have the latest CEO come in for these major companies, and it's a great way for them to get involved. So, in fact, I would say it's probably more more broadly effective.
Let me pick up. You mentioned calling the legislature. I had a conversation with a current member of the GPL. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure you would know, but I want to leave anonymous for purposes of this. And he was talking about the legislature, and he said, they won't return our calls, quote, they don't know who we are, which I found absolutely staggering.
I'm sure everybody has an opinion. I disagree with that one. I've had no trouble working with the legislature. I mean, we all go back to the dream legislature when Alfredo Gutierrez and Burton Barr were there.
We've talked about that many times here with them, not with Barr, but with Gutierrez and others.
And, you know, and with Bruce Babbitt as governor. Yeah. I mean, that was great. But I think that we have... As someone who really worked hard 15 years ago to convince the legislature that personalized medicine, genomics, medical research was a new opportunity for Arizona because nobody else was doing it. The human genome had just been decoded, and we were able to bring Jeff Trent here. We were able to bring some of the top intellectual capital from the Human Genome Project to Phoenix in the early 2001, 2002. I really found... that if you take the time, these people are out there because they want to be good for the state. They want to make good decisions. And I just think that whoever made that statement to you is probably a little more impatient than I am.
Let me give you a recent example. The discrimination ordinance that came out, it hit the fan nationally, and GPL stepped in after the fact, and GPL companies stepped in after the fact. This was the ordinance that was characterized to the legislature as a pro-religious freedom. The rest of the world
says an anti-gay.
Yeah, it was. The rest of the world saw it as a freedom to discriminate act. I want to suggest and get your reaction to the proposition that in the old days, the power structure would have seen that a legislation like that would have never seen the light of day. Instead, it gets passed. We get massive negative publicity. And then after the fact, only these companies come in and put pressure on the legislature to fix it.
Well, I'm, obviously have selective memory. And therefore, I like to remember all the times that we've gone out there ahead of time and started something. I just mentioned genomics.
Yep.
I think the state is bigger today and more fragmented today and more complex today than it was back in the 70s. Obviously, Phoenix is what now, the sixth or the seventh largest metropolitan area in the country?
Depending on how many people left Philadelphia last week.
Well, let's just say, if you do the count in March, you get a different result. I think that it's much more balkanized, much more fragmented. Obviously, we have very strong cities, Mesa, Chandler, Scottsdale, Glendale. I mean, Tucson is always going to have a certain amount of paranoia about Phoenix. These things can be overcome. And I think that Tom Franz and particularly Lisa Adkins did a brilliant job.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that the Phoenix 40, when Doc O'Neill challenged you with the quote that they've lost a little bit of the power, it's more toothless, and you disagreed with that. But you mentioned a key phrase in there, that the banks are now not controlled locally, that the major corporations here are not controlled locally, so that someone else has taken over. So if he who has the gold makes the rules, how much weight does the Phoenix 40 have? How much weight do you have without the backing of major names and major corporations?
Well, I disagree with your overemphasis on gold.
Okay.
Because I think that influence is based upon trust more than anything else. If people really trust that you have the best interest of the community at heart, that you're not being self-serving, and that you've been wide open with your disclosures, I think it's pretty easy to influence. At least that's been my belief. Mm-hmm. And, I think in terms of organizational theory, that is sort of the prevailing concept.
Do you think that's equally true now and 20 years ago?
I think it's always people. Look, mm-hmm. I'm a classicist. You know, I still think that Shakespeare, Plato, Socrates are as relevant today as they were many years ago. People don't change. You know, I think human nature is the same. And I think that the people were the same in the 70s as they are now in this decade. I mean, everybody wants a higher quality of life. They want to live longer. They want healthier lives. They want their children to get a good education. I was part of the effort many years ago to kind of bring Milton Friedman here to talk about charter schools. And I'd be the first to say that Arizona education is underfunded.
Arizona legislature apparently doesn't think so.
Well, I disagree with them. And I think if you want to look at a great economic engine, take a look at what enables California to survive despite a lot of stupid politicians, and that is that they have a very creative educational foundation there. Stanford.
When we have a little bit more time in the next segment, I want to go into that. I mm-hmm. want to go into TGen and all those related issues. But
we're up against a heartbreak here. So what we're going to do? So what we're going to do is we're going to come back with Dick Mallory of the Phoenix 40. We're going to dig into what we need to do, like you mentioned there, that other states are doing, especially when it comes to education. More on the Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Dick Mallory, and I want to talk about TGen. What is TGen? Why is it important, and how did you help bring this about in this community?
In December of 1999, my healthy, vibrant, lovely, brilliant, on wife came down with cancer, very aggressive. And so instead of our lives changed, and I suddenly became obsessed with cancer research. I watched her go through the medieval torture that was modern day cancer treatment. Radical surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, which is just poison.
Yeah.
And I went in to
see. You hope that it kills the bad stuff before it kills the good stuff. Yeah,
no matter what happens, if you continue it, it kills you. Mm-hmm. Any event, I went to her caregiver, Dan von Hoff, who was, in my opinion, one of the great oncologists in the world, and said, look, I'd like to do something. He said, this is a good time to do it. How do we get better treatment? He said, genomics. Well, I've been fascinated with biology all my life, evolutionary biology particularly, and I said, Dan, who's the best? He said, Jeff Trent. So literally the next day, Dan and I got on a plane, flew back to Bethesda, Maryland, and we met with Jeff Trent, who fortunately, serendipitously—
Happened to be from Phoenix.
Happened to be from Phoenix. And the genome was just, decoding was just about complete. And we said, Jeff, we'd like to help you apply the human genome to cancer. And he said, great. So we formed something called the International Genomics Consortium. I was the chair. And then IGC formed TGen. But in the process, we looked at Atlanta. Atlanta put $150 million on the table. And Houston and the University of Texas in Houston put $150 million on the table. And I couldn't... Literally, people didn't know what genomics was in Arizona. So the person who got it was Skip Remsa. And Skip Remsa...
then mayor of Phoenix, in case
then mayor of Phoenix,
forgotten.
Put up $47 million to, in effect, bring...
City money?
Yes, city money. Mm-hmm. IGC and TGen here. Jane Hull was most helpful. Greg Stanton, who was a member of the council, chaired the Bioscience Task Force to, in effect, bring it here. And within a very short period of time, we'd pulled together $150 million. And Jeff, of course, was happiest to come back to Arizona. I thought it was great because we didn't have any old institutions. We didn't have any old silos. We had nothing. And I saw that as
we had a lot of vacant land downtown, too.
Well, let's just say that's turned out to be a good thing because Skip decided not to do a Cardinal Stadium there, mm-hmm. which you use 10 times a year, and the rest of the time it's just concrete.
Come on, I'm a West Side guy. We have a bunch of wonderful events out there at the stadium every here and again.
Right, that's why the hockey team is prospering.
Oh, that was a softball.
Now, coming back, just remind.
I can come back.
I love it. I'm a professional button pusher here, dang it. So, but let's go back to that. Tell me the years that we're talking about in there with TGen and bringing TGen here, because we're talking about genomics and things like that, which is on the – everybody knows what genomics is now. How long ago was this?
Genomics was decoded in 2001. Mm-hmm. We started IGC in 2001. We started TGen in 2002.
Okay.
We based it putting together a joint venture. You know, one of the things I've done professionally is sort of get people to come together and focus on what they agree on and not what they disagree on. Mm-hmm. And so we put together a joint venture called TGen, which is really a joint venture among ASU, U of A, and NAU. And NAU was well ahead of us because they have this marvelous anthrax lab up there. We started doing our inventory. And our inventory included Mayo, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. The U of A has tremendous resources in biology. I think that the informatics is where you, in effect, use computers to personalize the medicine. When you do a molecular profile, you're taking a picture of the cellular structure, and that's when you can see the DNA and begin to see what they call markers.
Hmm.
And that's how you determine what kind of cancer it is and where you find it, because cancer moves around your system when it metastasizes. So at any rate, we put together a very, very great collaboration among the Arizona universities. And then Dan Von Hoff said, it'd be nice to have a medical school here. And we worked to establish the U of A College of Medicine in Phoenix, which is a fantastic addition to the scene. So we had literally everything we needed except early stage venture capital. The venture capitalists from California come over here, take good ideas, and start them over there. And so our real challenge is how to start things here. One of the things that IGC did, the International Genomics Consortium, was start something called the Molecular Profiling Institute. 2.5 years later, we sold it for $40 million cash to Caris Life Sciences in Dallas. Now, keep in mind, this has been pro bono for me. I'm not, you know, this is not a business effort. This mm-hmm. is, you know, this is strictly a public service as far as I'm concerned. But we used that money to capitalize TGen and IGC. And we also started what was called the Atlas Project for the National Cancer Institute, which is where we're in effect doing a molecular profile of all cancers. And that was started here, and that is operated here, and that is an international resource. It's the best biobank in the world.
I don't know anybody who doesn't know about it, who doesn't think that TGen is a wonderful thing here. I wonder if locally, though, sometimes we just don't get the scale. Compare this. You went to Stanford. You've seen Silicon Valley. My sense is TGen's a wonderful thing, but, God, they've got 100 of them.
Well, we are definitely not in the, you know, we are not the top-tier bioresearch center mm-hmm. in the world. That is at Stanford today. That's mm-hmm. that's at UC, University of California at San Francisco, that's at Berkeley, and that's great. But we serve them by IGC is just a research platform. Mm-hmm. TGen is a research engine. It goes in there and mines the data. But we have been attracting some great bio-entrepreneurs like like John Kapoor. John Kapoor is a brilliant pharmacist from India. He started a company called Insys Therapeutics, based out in Chandler. It was the best performing IPO of 2013. But going back to the dates, we started all of this in 2002, and we form and over the, between 2002 and 2010, we put in place everything that you see today. But it's like everything else. This isn't this is a marathon. You have to continuously.
And your up against aren't standing still.
No, that's in fact, my favorite metaphor comes out of the Red Queen metaphor out of Alice in Wonderland, where Alice and the Queen are going through the forest and they see the trees moving with them. And so they walk a little faster, then run a little faster, and the trees keep keeping pace. You have to run really, really fast in this game to stay in the same place. And that's what's going on in Phoenix today.
It's an amazing story of where we've come from to where we are in such a short time. I mean, especially the T-Gen as an example. I mean, please.
I'm 78. I don't have a lot of time.
Oh, well, hurry up, will you? Good night, a living. Dick Mallory of the Phoenix 40, and as you mentioned it, the ghost of Phoenix 40 passed. Come on, just keep it going. You're doing a great job,
thank
and
you.
We thank you for all that you're doing, and we thank you for all that you have done and continue to do great work. Thank you so much. We really
Most
appreciate
welcome.
You being
thank
here.
Thank you for having me today.
Thank you. Doc and I are going to tie a bow around it. We come back right here on the Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
The big thank you to Dick Mallory, man. He's on it. I mean, he knows everything about Arizona. He's a lot like you, Doc. You guys have just lived this, breathed this.
Oh, this, no. I've been an observer. This guy has been a doer.
He's done
when,
it.
When the door closes and the guys get in the room making the decision, I've been on the outside. He's been on the inside.
Sure.
There's a big difference.
Now, and I mentioned him as he was leaving the studio. I mentioned that we didn't even get to California. And,
oh, that comment was.
I know. Let me tell you. We'll get to that in a second. Let's go back to that. But we will get to California, I assure you, because I have notes. I'm ready. Yeah. I am just loaded for bear. Look, here's what I get the vibe. And we've had some really great minds on this show. And we've had some great people from Arizona's history that have shaped this state on our show. And what I'm finding out, and I think that Dick Mallory just kind of just brought that all together for me, is that Arizona has a group of people, the Dick Mallorys of the world, the Gutierrezes of the world. They're doing their darndest to make this baby state, because we are a baby state, make this baby state the greatest
adolescent. I'd say
we graduated. Yeah. But to make it the great, to make it a great, amazing state where people yearn to be, where businesses just are lining up to be a part of, where education is phenomenal. They are working very hard for that, but it takes time.
Yeah.
You know, it takes time. How long? We're not very patient. Like he said, he's 78. He doesn't have much time left.
And I'm not sure if we're overall moving in the right direction. The T-Gen's a wonderful development, but as I asked him in a question, you know, I said, you know, but if you go to Silicon Valley, there's 100 like that. It was a wonderful thing. It was an incredible coup. It's harder to pull off the first one because you got nothing there.
Sure.
The second one's a little easier, but essentially there's such a fertile ground in California where there is a synergy of scores and scores of entities like that, and they all spawn children.
Are you all baby children companies?
Well, and I mean, there's a whole community there, you know, the people who are, you know, have an idea and they're in one company, they walk down the street, start a new company, have access to financing and intellectual capital all in the same neighborhood.
Right, and I understand that. Silicon Valley is its own little world. Yeah, it could be its own country and thrive. But let me, if you're going to pull in California, let's pull in California. Because we brought up education, we just skimmed over it.
Yep.
We just skimmed over education. And in California is running one of the biggest deficits of any state in this country. They have cities that are going bankrupt at a quick clip. And so why in the world would I say California? They've got it all figured out. That makes zero sense to me. We have, what, three bankrupt cities so far in the last year?
It's one of the massive economic engines of the entire world.
On other people's money. On borrowed money is what it is. It's Monopoly in California. I'm from there. I have family there. I've lived there. I've started raising my first child there. I understand California and I see it firsthand. If we all look at it and marvel about how wonderful it is, we are going right down that same sinkhole.
Depends on whether you want a $100,000 a year job or $8 an hour schlepping ice cream.
Well, okay, so $100,000. There was a person here at KTAR that recently moved to Manhattan. And I was told what his salary was, and people were absolutely amazed by it. And I thought, in Manhattan, that gets you squat. You'll be lucky if you can get a parking space for that type of dough. So
it is true that when you have a desirable place, prices get bid up.
I'm not against it. I would just never live there.
I mean, you look at Silicon Valley. The real estate prices are sky high because you have people turning around in 20-somethings getting multi-million dollars in stock options, and then they want to buy a house, and they pay cash, and they got more money than God.
Understood that, but you said you want to live in California with a $100,000 a year job, or do you want to be over here slapping $8 an hour?
Yeah, I think you're still way ahead of the game, but it is true the dollar, you know, if you've got a fixed amount of money and you want to retire and you want to live well on it, we look pretty good for that game.
Darn right we do.
But if you're still in your productive years and you're trying to change the world, there's something to be said being an environment where all that stuff is
going on. If you want to change the world, go to California and live on someone else's money and build that up and sell it and move back over here and retire. That's fine. Yeah. But to look at California, look at the state of California as this amazing example of success, I think it's silly.
Look, for example, at the universities. Berkeley and UCLA are among the premier institutions in the world.
Fine.
Those are public.
I'm not arguing.
Local provincialism aside, we ain't in that league.
Okay.
And that is the sustained results of decades of support. You can't fix that one overnight.
I don't think you can.
And frankly, in that sense, we're going in the wrong direction. We're starving education at the university level, at the K-12 level.
That's our own dang fault. Now, let me tell you why. You see Arizona State as the highest populated university
largest
in the country.
It is the largest.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
In part because.
And you're worried
Phoenix,
about not having money?
Phoenix was the largest city in America that essentially had only one education institution.
Okay. That's
fine. Now there's because of that, there's a lot of smaller schools that have moved to the Phoenix area. That's no longer true, but metropolitan area in the country is as dominated by one higher education institution as Phoenix and ASU.
I have the most people paying me. Why aren't I the best institution in the country?
History is a lot of it.
History.
Long-term funding is an issue, but
my point is you can't throw money at this and fix it.
It's complicated. That's true, but you also can't do it without money.
Okay.
That's the dilemma. In other words, if you get piles of money, you can misspend it and you can blow it. Absolutely. But if you have no resources, you're never going to get anywhere. That's obviously. And the same is true of school districts. They can mismanage money, but you do not get them to fix anything by starving them. That just takes you into the tank.
Okay.
I mean, we have.
Are they starving?
Down. Yeah. Yeah,
come on.
We have, look at teacher salaries. Teachers are leaving Arizona in droves. They're having trouble filling the classroom.
I would too if I was a teacher. I would say pound sand everybody. You know why? Because I almost took a picture just for you yesterday, but I was late to my appointment of my favorite new elementary school district administration building, brand spanking new. Would love to. Next time, I promise. Next time, I'll take a picture of it just for you, Doc.
I am not an advocate of that.
It's just they mismanage funds and then they cry.
I think just in our education system in general, we probably put too much into hardware and not enough into intellectual resources.
Amen, brother.
Mallory was leaving, we were talking about the issue of California and why they are able to do stuff. And his number one answer was essentially intellectual capital.
Sure.
They have the brain power, the smart people to make it happen. I would say the same thing about if I were king and running the schools, I wouldn't worry too much about the physical buildings. I'd worry about the teachers, the people running the institutions.
Preaching to the choir, buddy.
And that, by the way, is also European model. Look at the top country. You go to top country in the world is Finland. You go in, their physical schools are not at all impressive. Ours are palatial by comparison.
Yes.
But their teachers are paid double.
And I think that's the way it should be here.
And you have to die to get it. I mean,
getting
a teaching job in that country is like becoming a neurosurgeon in America.
Here it's please. Because everyone's leaving so fast.
Let's go. It's a vicious cycle. We pay very little. So you bring in people. They get burned out after a year or two. They discover they're not earning anything. And they're abused and maltreated. And they just quit. And so we bring in another novice. And it's a vicious cycle, never gets any.
Here's one thing I will hand to California. It's one that they play at a higher level than we do. It's when you talk about that, the brain power. If you were a brainiac and you were a highly touted person in this world, right? In the T-gens of the world, the biology world, whatever it is. And they say, we got a great place in Phoenix for you, or we have a great place in Huntington Beach, California. You're going to go to California.
95%.
It's California.
Jeff Tent was a major coup on the part of Dick Mallory.
Sure.
He put together a heck of a package for him. But, you know, it's also a return home. Sometimes that has a...
Sure.
It was a major coup.
But I'm talking about, like, for the brain trust, the executives, the scientists, the people that are making the next level.
You want to
live in California.
Where the world is filled with people that are going to pull you up.
No, you want to go where it's California. You want to go and live in California. That's what I'm saying. Just the
fact
that it's California.
Because of who else is there.
Because of beaches and climate.
No,
let's be real.
They also want to go to Manhattan. They want to go to Boston. They want to go to Portland, Seattle.
Good luck. They deserve what they get.
There are places where you're surrounded by the very top people, and that's why it's very tough to get into that game.
And it's chicken and the egg argument,
yes,
because it
absolutely
started, everybody wanted to live on the coast. I mean, heck yeah, that's where we want to set up shop, right? When it's affordable. Now it's not affordable, but if you have your choice,
live with
to
it
go
anyway.
With it.
We live with the fact that it's unaffordable because we want to live in that community.
So as far as the community goes, I'm going to agree with you. As far as the community, the brain power in that in California, I'm going to agree with you. But as far as how they run that place fiscally, it's the biggest disaster of disasters.
Government's another matter, yeah.
Amen to that, brother. All right. Hey, holy cow. Now, thanks, Dick Mallory, for hanging out with us, spending some time with us. Thanks, Doc O'Neill. On behalf of the entire KTAR team, I'm Mike Russell. This has been The Think Tank.